Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, in for Rose Aguilar today, and this is your call's Friday Media Roundtable. So much to get to in a busy news week, so let's get right to it. Joining me today will be three veteran journalists from Washington, D.C., Ian McDougall. Ian is a senior reporting fellow at ProPublica. He is an attorney and a journalist who's written about crime, criminal justice, and legal affairs for Harper's, The Atlantic, and Slate. Ian McDougall, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us from New York is Craig Unger. Craig is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, and he's the author of several books, including House of Bush, House of Saud. His new book is called House of Trump, House of Putin. The subtitle is The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. Craig Unger, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
By the way, I've read both. It's extraordinary. I highly recommend them. And joining me later in the program to discuss the increasingly fraught relationship between the United States and Iran, as well as the latest in the mysterious death of Jamal Khashoggi, will be Farnaz Fasihi. She's an award-winning Iranian-American writer for The Wall Street Journal. A lot to get to this week, and I'd like to start with our weekly kudos. Such a busy week, everything from national election recounts to deadly fires. So I'd like to ask each of you, Ian and Craig, what reporting stood out for you this week? Ian McDougall, you first, please.
Sure. But, there are actually two pieces. One was by Tim Goldman and Sebastian Rotella in ProPublica with Univision, and the other one was Adam Entus and John Lee Anderson in The New Yorker. Both were writing about one of the sort of enduring mysteries the last couple of years, what happened to these diplomats in Cuba who've experienced this brain trauma after hearing strange noises and no one can quite figure out what's going on. They're both really tremendous pieces and really interesting insights into that question.
And Craig Unger, your thoughts on outstanding reporting of the week?
Right. Well, there's been a lot of good reporting on Matthew Whitaker, and among them I saw an excellent piece in Vox by Murray Watts, in which he goes into Whitaker's what Whitaker was doing before he was appointed acting attorney general and the many conflicts he has.
There's a lot to get to on Mr. Whitaker, on acting AG Whitaker. We're going to delve into that thoroughly during the first 40 minutes of the show. Ian McDougall, let's start with you. Seems like months ago that Jeff Sessions was ousted, maybe because Trump has been signaling for months that Sessions had one foot out the door and the other on a banana peel, but it's actually only been a few days since he was unceremoniously pushed out. So let's talk about the Sessions firing. He was such a loyal supporter of Trump. He not only went along with so many Trump policies, but he actually helped engineer them, everything from immigration to the Muslim ban. By the way, Sessions was the attorney general in Alabama when I was a reporter in Birmingham, and his policies haven't changed very much. They were highly racially charged then as now. So his nomination as AG was fiercely opposed by civil rights groups, but he seemed to be well aligned with the policies of President Trump. So why was he fired, Egan? Ian, why? What was the given reason, if any?
Well, I mean, I don't think there was necessarily a given reason. I don't have great insight into what was going on behind the scenes besides what I've read in the papers. But, I gather there's been a longstanding tension between the two of them over Jeff Sessions' recusal in the Russia investigation. Though, as you say correctly, besides that, he's been really a quite effective AG, especially when it comes to how he's handled what was a quite robust police reform effort under the Obama administration that was opposed by many of the police unions that were big supporters of Donald Trump.
Looking back, I imagine Jeff Sessions would probably maybe make another choice. I think he was part of the search group looking for a potential vice president, and a la Dick Cheney, I think he was hoping he would actually get that slot. He didn't, but he ended up giving up his Senate seat, which was later won by a Democrat. So, and now he's been forced out unceremoniously. So I don't know if you have any insights, Craig, on whether you think maybe if he had it all to do again, he would, or if because he has had such far-reaching impact with his policies that he feels like mission accomplished. Craig?
How he feels, but from the outside, I think what sort of dramatic is that here you have Jeff Sessions is a guy who was excoriated by liberals. He is had some openly racist past and very, very conservative. He was also one of Trump's first supporters, and it's been widely reported that during the transition period, Sessions was meeting with the Russian ambassador Sergei Kislyak. So that was, of course, required him to recuse himself, and now he's almost being seen as a martyr by liberals because he was actually upholding one of the few the rule of law by recusing himself and not putting himself in a conflicted position with regard to the Russian investigation.
Did you ever think that you would see people, liberals and progressives, marching through the streets of American cities holding signs in support of Jefferson Beauregard Sessions? What a change, right?
Exactly.
Craig Unger, also, you have profiled Donald Trump in your book, House of Trump, House of Putin. And in some ways, you describe how that relationship was formed. So I'm wondering if it gave you any insights that would help you to characterize the complicated relationship with Jeff Sessions. How was that relationship forged?
Well, Trump's relationship with Russia, I go way back into the late 70s and early 80s, and I actually show in 1984, Trump met with a Russian member of the Russian mafia named David Bogdan, who wanted to buy 5 condos. He came in with $6 million in cash. That's the equivalent of about $15 million today. And he bought 5 condos. In effect, he was using Trump real estate to launder money for the Russian mafia. So you have this extraordinary relationship that goes back more than 30 years. If you look at Trump Tower, 721 Fifth Avenue here in New York, it's one of the glitziest buildings in the country, yet it was a very high crime area because the Russian mafia was very much centered there. And when you realize their ties to Russian intelligence, that they are part of Russian intelligence, that they are operating, partnering with, laundering money with the President of the United States, it's sort of horrifying. And you have to wonder how an attorney general would he really crack down on it. And I don't think Sessions ever would have done it. I'm sure he's glad he recused himself. But this is what remains to be seen when the Mueller report is released and when the Democrats take over Congress and subpoenas, I think we'll start flying, and perhaps we'll see some of this stuff become more public.
You know, actually, with all due respect, I think it's really extraordinary that so much of this information is hiding in plain sight. They've been turning over rocks for the last 2 years and finding this kind of information that's pretty readily available. Thanks to Craig Unger, it's been put in context in terms of the relationship between Trump and Putin and the U.S. and Russia going forward. But Ian McDougall, it seems as if all of this information is out there, but there's apparently no consequence, at least thus far.
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of it sort of depends on, you know, many of the sort of business issues that have come up later on about the Trump Organization and its past. You know, there's a statute of limitations on a lot of that kind of stuff. And, you know, a lot of the other things like, you know, meeting with foreign officials and so on, that it's not there's not a legal prohibition against that as such. So I think there remains a question of how much of this is sort of things that are perhaps bad optics or politically might have consequences versus legal consequences, which are a very different kind of thing.
And given that there's been a shift in the House of Representatives, do you have a prediction on how that will impact things going forward after January?
I've learned better than to try to predict these kinds of things. But, the truth of it is the House, Judiciary Intelligence Oversight Committees, the Democrats there will now have subpoena power, something they've lacked in at times bitterly so in the last couple of years. So you can imagine that will make a difference in terms of how they will attempt to investigate various things related to the administration, the Trump campaign. But I couldn't speak to how precisely that will shake out.
Mm-hmm. Greg, you seem to have insights into Trump based on your book. He seems to have a need for sycophants, folks who think he's just swell. So Trump picked Matthew Whitaker to be the acting attorney general. Who is he, if you could shed some light on maybe why he may have been picked to be the acting attorney general?
Right. Well, he's from Iowa. He played football for the University of Iowa, the Hawkeye, and he's 6'4", around 240 pounds, sort of an intimidating person compared to Sessions, who I think is 5'5", so he was towering over him. But there was a lot of... He ran for several offices unsuccessfully in Iowa, and he became chief of staff for Sessions. And as such, he was pretty much the eyes and ears of the Trump administration, spying on the Justice Department. And in a well-run administration, The White House and the Justice Department are not supposed to be in touch with each other. There's supposed to be a separation of powers. But Trump wanted eyes and ears spying on the Mueller investigation, and that's sort of what he got from Whitaker, who was, there was very interesting videos you may have seen. One he said, and one Trump says that he likes Whitaker very much. He's a terrific guy. And subsequently, he says he doesn't know Whitaker at all. And so you see him backtracking. But essentially, I think in those conversations with Trump, Whitaker was sort of auditioning to be the fox inside the hen house, and that's the job he got.
And a recent tweet, I believe it was yesterday, from the president indicating that there's chaos behind the scenes in the Mueller investigation. The obvious question now, just how would you know that unless there is some reconnaissance going on? Do you have any doubt that that is happening?
Well, I strongly suspect it. I mean, I don't have any specific knowledge as to whether or not that came from Whitaker, but obviously that's where someone would look in terms of the recent reporting.
Well, I think even progressives have been really concerned about what the implications were of the firing of Jeff Sessions and the fact that it could still lead to a constitutional crisis and put the Mueller investigation into uncharted territory. It's actually being his dismissal or firing or resignation, whatever you want to call it, is being characterized as a slow motion version of the Saturday night massacre that led to Richard Nixon's downfall. So, Ian, wondering, what does Trump's new act mean for the Mueller investigation?
Well, I mean, the truth is nobody knows. Within the Justice Department more broadly, people I've talked to, there's sort of a great deal of uncertainty and confusion. I mean, he hasn't been there for that long, really, and people don't really know what to expect. How long will he be there? Will he pay attention to, what will his priorities be? Will they be the same as Jeff Sessions's were? Will he, focus in on other areas? Sessions, as you said, was focused on things like immigration, policing, things like that. The truth is there's like a lot of confusion, and people are as eager as I think the rest of the country is to sort of see what this means for not just the Mueller investigation, but for the Department of Justice in general.
If you're just joining us, Ian McDougall is a senior reporting fellow at ProPublica. He's also an attorney and a journalist who's written about crime, criminal justice, and legal affairs for Harper's, The Atlantic, and Slate. And also Craig Unger, contributing editor at Vanity Fair and author of the new book House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. 866-798-8255 is the number for the Friday Media Roundtable. What news stories stood out for you this week? Ian, if you don't mind, I'm going to circle back to you. Before leaving, Jeff Sessions created a memorandum that covers everything from environmental policy to civil rights issues. Could you discuss that memorandum and just unpack it for us and what the implications might be of that?
Sure. So essentially what it said is for parts of the Justice Department that enter into these agreements with states and cities, so that includes when states and cities are responsible for cleaning up pollution or when there's a problem with their police department where they've been repeatedly violating people's civil rights in the context of voting rights problems. There are sort of two flavors of them. One, that was the focus of the memo, is called the consent decree. It's basically a long-term reform plan that the Justice Department and the state or city enter into, and a federal judge oversees it, you know, has the ability to hold state or city officials in contempt of court if they don't abide by the agreement and even recommend their prosecution, which is sort of what happened with Joe Arpaio in Arizona before the president pardoned him. And so what this memo does is it basically sets a series of hurdles in the way of getting any of those agreements. Now, most people have focused on the police reform side of things, but the truth is that was sort of already had been fairly well dismantled by Sessions and his deputies by the time this memo came out, though it does give Sessions kind of dead hand control over that policy after he's left. But where it really has a big impact is there's a certain set of voting rights cases where they were still using these decrees under the Trump administration, and the environmental division was using them still. And I know in particular in the environmental division, there's a great deal of concern and confusion and uncertainty about what this will mean for them. They're afraid it will sort of make them hamstring their ability to do what is very important work that, you know, every day that goes by without a cleanup of a pollution site happening is a day that people locally can be sickened by it. So it's something that appears in some ways to be animated by his police reform concerns, but it's actually quite a bit broader than that, nominally because he's concerned about state sovereignty and the federal government interfering in states' state self-determination.
Well, states' rights, and once again, that was something that was one of Alabama's most important legacies in terms of going back to the 50s and 60s and even back to the 40s. But he also made clear during his tenure that the Justice Department would no longer bring actions against police departments for a pattern and practice of violating civil rights, and mandated that people arrested for federal crimes, including drug offenses, should be charged to the max. So, you know, talk about, if you would, the police reform part of it.
Sure. So that was something that the Obama administration had really pushed hard for and really had used in a quite robust way to try to address, you know, police departments where there were really sort of serious systematic problems with the civil rights violations. And they used these consent decrees I talked about in that sessions, both for the state sovereignty reasons we talked about and also because he felt they sort of undermined law enforcement's work. He really did not like that police reform work, and he essentially from the start came in, and I mean, he'd said this before he became AG, but as AG he came in and from the start, you know, in meetings was, he and his deputies were asking questions like, you know, why do we do this at all? They wanted to review all of the existing consent decrees that were already in place, and really put the brakes on doing any new work. Although they did eventually do a little bit to sort of wrap up some of the Obama era cases, but they tried to put the brakes on one in Baltimore, which ultimately went through, and they did put the brakes on one in Chicago. Now, in fairness to Sessions, there are questions about how effective consent decrees are. They can be, for example, expensive for cities, though there's a growing body of empirical evidence that suggests they make a difference. And as one Justice Department attorney put it to me on the cost side, you know, the Fourth Amendment doesn't say you can't have unreasonable searches and seizures, you know, unless you can't afford to do otherwise as a city. So the truth of it, and I think what most people rightly believe, is he's very beholden to police unions, and police unions have really not liked this police reform work. So that's what animated a lot of that.
866-798-8255 is the number. What news stories stood out for you this week? Feel free to give us a call. You know, it strikes me in listening to Ian's description of the legacy that's being left behind, that on some level the media has created this real anticipation and build up to the Mueller investigation, and I'm wondering, Craig Unger, is it likely that the media may have built it up so much that many progressives in particular are expecting nothing short of impeachable offenses to have been found, and anything less than that will be a letdown? Craig?
Built up, but I think things are... I think it will be an explosive year coming up, and that really the various things are going to start to hit the fan. Whether it will all be at once, I don't know. I think it's not just Mueller, but I think we can expect to see some more indictments. And I think when the Democrats take control in January, you're going to see one subpoena after another. What I really hope will start to happen that hasn't happened yet is I think this country needs and deserves a shared national narrative. And most of us have been bombarded with dozens of news stories every week, and it's hard to put them all together. And I think people are sort of siloed into their different little demographics, whether there's liberal elites on the coast or alt-right. The people don't understand. There's no shared national story about this. And I think when we start to have congressional hearings with the House Intelligence Committee, you're going to see people like Felix Sater or Michael Cohen, who are sort of minor characters now, but they should be on everyone's radar screen because they play a major, major role in what really happened in the events leading up to Trump's election.
Well, certainly, I'm wondering, too, if you have any thoughts on just how much impact Matthew Whitaker can have as acting attorney general. It seems like the new narrative that Republicans are putting out in the media is, well, he's only temporary, and they're trying to push up the date of considering and confirming a permanent replacement. But the question becomes just how much shuttle discussion is going on between Matthew Whitaker and the White House already. Particularly since I think most people are expecting that the real blockbuster in any Mueller report will be serious questions about financial ties between Russia and Trump. And so Matthew Whitaker is already on record as saying that this is a witch hunt, that going too far in examining the Trump family finances would be a red line. So, Craig, is it quite possible that Matthew Whitaker can derail the financial inquiries that people have placed so many expectations upon?
Right. Well, I think we're definitely in uncharted waters on this, and I talked to a federal prosecutor this week who had worked with Robert Mueller for many years, and he said he would be absolutely stunned if Mueller had not guarded against this, and that he'd already filed sealed indictments in multiple jurisdictions that were already in the system, and that Whitaker would not be able to stop even if he started. In addition, As I say, these are uncharted waters, so I don't know the answer to these questions. But it's just 6 weeks until the Democrats take over Congress, and Whitaker will have to be responsive to the Democrats when they can hold Congress. So I don't think he wants to get too far out over his skis, or he may himself be in jeopardy if he were to quash the investigation in an illegal manner. There was an op-ed piece in the New York Times this week by Neil Katyal and George Conway. Conway is the husband of Kellyanne Conway, and Neil y'all was a former acting Solicitor General, and they made a very, very strong case that Whitaker's appointment was actually unconstitutional and illegal, and if he were to take certain actions to stop the investigation, that too might be illegal.
Craig Unger, editor at Vanity Fair and author, along with Ian McDougall, a fellow at ProPublica. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about that New York Times report on Facebook. How much did they know about Russian election meddling, and did they cover it up? We'll be right back.
You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco. Better when you participate. Call 866-798-TALK to add your comment to today's discussion. 866-798-TALK. Coming up at 11, it's 1A from WAMU in Washington, D.C. More on the Brexit, on the latest Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and more. Stay with us here on KALW if you can.
Hello, welcome back. For those of you just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp in for Rose Aguilar, and this is the Friday Your Call Media Roundtable. We are podcasting the show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for the newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea, drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org. Today we've been discussing the fate of the Mueller investigation, plus the Trump cabinet and Jeff Sessions in particular. And still ahead, we'll take a look at what's happening between the U.S. and Iran, the impact of new sanctions and the future of U.S. relations, plus the mysterious ongoing case of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. What news story stood out for you this week? 866-798-8255 is the number to call. On Monday's One Planet series, a conversation with investigative journalist Mark Shapiro about his new book, Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply. Thousands of seed varieties are now being snatched right off the market, replaced by genetically engineered seeds provided by agribusiness. How to protect the food supply in the face of climate volatility. That's Monday's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Today we're talking to Ian McDougall, senior fellow reporting fellow at ProPublica, and Craig Unger. His new book is House of Trump, House of Putin. And we're talking about, we've been talking about the Trump administration, but I think it's critical, guys, if we just touch on that blockbuster New York Times report on Facebook suggesting that Facebook knew about Russian election meddling using their platform. They then allegedly covered it up and then used opposition research to try to silence their critics, blaming George Soros in what came off as something like an anti-Semitic attack on George Soros. So, Ian McDougall, can you tackle this one first? What did you think of the article?
Oh, I mean, it's tremendously reported. I mean, that that set of Times reporters are really sort of the cream of the crop and really had a well-told and disturbing and distressing story. I think perhaps the best measure of that is how hard Facebook seems to have been pushing back or seems to be pushing back against it in the wake of it. You know, you mentioned the Soros aspect of there's sort of a, put it mildly, a dark irony to them using essentially the same tactic that they probably ought to have been combating instead.
Ironies abound.
Craig, yes, yeah, mm-hmm. I think that's right.
Craig Unger, you're thinking on the New York Times article, and they spent a long time and a lot of resources digging this story up. What were your thoughts about it?
Well, I think Ian's absolutely right, and I think it's a hugely important area to go in because the tech sector has been sort of untouched by regulation, and it's amassed hundreds of billions, actually trillions of dollars. And now with Facebook, I think we see some of the dangers of what has happened, that billions of people have signed up for Facebook, not realizing that they're sort of giving away their privacy, and that it can be used in a powerful way to interfere with a presidential election. So I think it was a really important article, and I hope it leads to something, because I think a lot of Silicon Valley needs to be regulated.
Which is, of course, exactly what Facebook is most afraid of. Any antitrust action taken by Congress is just their worst possible nightmare. So given that Democrats will be taking over in January, does this reporting move any closer to antitrust actions, Craig Unger?
I think it will. I mean, I don't know exactly what the Democrats have in mind, but Senator Amy Klobuchar has been talking a little about Facebook, and I think you know, we've clearly entered the social media age, and I think one of the downsides of it is you see the way our media has been segmented, that there was that heinous story, a ridiculous story known as Pizzagate during the election, that said Hillary Clinton had a sex sexual cult going in the basement of a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C. It was completely fabricated, of course, but on Facebook it got enormous traction, and then you had some very serious reporting by, say, the Financial Times on money laundering in Trump buildings, and that was completely buried. And I think that's one of the problems that social media has caused, that has affected the election.
And I think the other issue is how Facebook wants to describe itself, and how that definition is a moving target. Ian McDougall, I thought it was interesting that Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer gave Facebook some cover the last time this issue came before Congress. He basically defended Facebook. Is that likely to change in the face of this article being published?
You know, I don't know. Call me a cynic, but you know, neither the Democrats nor the Republicans have been very good on, well, it depends on your policy preferences, but very forceful on antitrust enforcement. The truth is, it's not necessarily a matter of enacting new laws. Even antitrust, the laws that exist, the Sherman Act and so on, are deliberately have a lot of give in them, and it's really, you've seen it over the years, Microsoft in the 90s, you know, for example, where it really takes the Justice Department or the Federal Trade Commission stepping in and saying, we're going to try to tackle this new industry and apply antitrust principles to it. There's a good book that just came out, I think this week, by a professor at Columbia named Tim Wu, called The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age. And for anyone who's interested in these questions, he's really been at the forefront of that discussion.
And again, as someone who works with ProPublica as an investigative journalist and in an outlet that specializes in that sort of journalism, how has social media, Facebook in particular, changed how people are consuming their news?
I mean, it's radically reformed it. You know, it's sort of one of the main channels through which people consume news, including legacy media, the New York Times and so on, and including, I mean, journalists consume news that way. Now, I don't use Facebook quite as much, but I use Twitter a lot, and I come across stories frequently there first. And I click through and read the actual article, but it's a quick move from there, and you see this happen with even very smart people, to sort of just believing whatever gets put out there by certain people, even if it's not, you know, based on the New York Times article, but based on supposition and just guesswork. I think that inevitably that's how people are going to consume news these days and for the foreseeable future. But it has a major, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it has a major downside that we've obviously seen play out.
And it's difficult, I think, for those who try to cover this phenomenon. It's sort of a moving target because they can legitimately describe themselves in various ways that may or may not come under scrutiny by legislative bodies. Ian McDougall, senior reporter, reporting fellow at ProPublica, lawyer, journalist, who's written about crime, criminal justice, and legal affairs for Harper's, The Atlantic, and Slate. Thank you so much for being here for the first 40 minutes of the show. And Craig Unger, contributing editor at Vanity Fair and author of the new book, House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. Thank you both so much for being here for the lion's share of the program today.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, award-winning Iranian-American journalist Farnaz Fasahi. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us for the last third of the program. Joining me now to discuss the increasingly fraught relationship between the United States and Iran is Farnaz Fasahi. She's an award-winning Iranian-American writer for the Wall Street Journal. She joins us by phone from New York. Farnaz, welcome. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, indeed. Well, first, let's start with the latest on what might be the Trump administration's possible attempt to lower tension in the Jamal Khashoggi case. It appears that the Trump administration has, at the very least, floated a trial balloon, a possible concession to Turkey and Recep Erdogan, the possibility that they floated of deporting Erdogan's longtime enemy from the United States. Can you bring us up to speed on that?
There was a report in NBC yesterday that the Trump administration is considering trying to legally remove one of Erdogan's foes and critics who has a green card and resides in Pennsylvania back to somewhere, whether it's extradite him back to Turkey or there was an idea to floating around to send him to South Africa. This is, of course, extremely disturbing because usually when dissidents apply for political asylum in the United States or are granted political asylum, unless they've somehow breached security or there's some reason, they're not usually removed because of political negotiations between the U.S. and another country. Throughout this, the murder and the aftermath of the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, we've seen Turkey's President Erdogan sort of strategize the release of the information, the incremental leaks to local media and other media. And most analysts and Turkey watchers believe that he was trying to leverage the information he had on the possible link to Saudi officials and maybe the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to the murder in order to gain some leverage, whether that was more investments from Saudi, whether it was to remove sanctions, U.S. sanctions, and now it seems that it was to negotiate somehow to get his critic and enemy out of the United States, as he's been lobbying for many years.
Well, it's not as though, even though Turkey is a NATO ally, it's not as if Turkey has had that close a relationship with the United States. When the United States wanted to invade Iraq, Turkey denied the United States access to its facility. So why appear to try to kowtow to Turkey?
I don't know. That's a question for the administration to answer. I think that we know that the Trump administration has very close ties to Saudi Arabia. We've seen President Trump say that you know, oil sales and arms purchases are important for him, and if there was any damage to the ties, that the U.S. would lose millions of dollars or billions of dollars of arms sales. There's also, this administration is very hostile to Iran, and they see Saudi Arabia as an ally to sort of increase the pressure on Iran. And, you know, since the Trump administration took office, they've really centered their Middle East policy around the Saudi-Iran tension. Instead of trying to come up with a Middle East policy that would actually ease tensions in the region, they've been playing this sectarian tension, this power play between Saudi and Iran, to actually drive more division and more fear in the Middle East.
So it's not so much a concession to Turkey and Erdogan, so much as it's an attempt to lower tension on Saudi Arabia.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's not really about Turkey or Erdogan. It's really to try to save Saudi Arabia, particularly try to save any links to the Crown Prince, which Jared Kushner is very close to, and the Trump administration has hailed as a reformer. Of course, all of that is now being questioned in light of the Khashoggi murder and also in light of the Yemen war. We've seen that since the Crown Prince really took power, many of Saudi Arabia's foreign policies have been spectacular failures. The war in Yemen, today at the United Nations, where I am, we just had a briefing by the executive director of World Food Program, and he said 14 to 18 million people are at the brink of famine, that the economy is collapsing, that the hospitals can only take 20 children. The hospital in Sana'a can only take 20 children per day, and there are about 50 children that show up at the hospital, and they have to turn 30 kids away to die. I mean, that is really shameful. So, you know, Saudi's policies in Yemen with the Qatar blockade, with kidnapping of Lebanon's Prime Minister Saad Hariri, these have all proven to be failures. And now the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, they've sort of backlashed against Saudi. So, you know, there's got to be some reckoning, I assume, in the foreign policy establishment of the United States as to how much longer are they going to really center the foreign policy based on Saudi interests and saving Saudi Arabia as an ally.
It appears that House Democrats have introduced a bill a couple of days ago to stop arms sales and to curtail curtail the intelligence and air support. The GOP blocked that. Do you have an insight on the latest on that?
I unfortunately don't have the latest on that. You mean the arms sales to Saudi Arabia because of Yemen?
Yes.
Yes, I think pressure is really increasing on Yemen. As we've seen pictures of these starving children show up on the front pages of newspapers like the New York Times and circulated on social media, there's been a public outcry, and the situation is really bad. And I think, you know, Western countries like the U.S. and U.K. and, you know, that are allies of the Saudi-led coalition or are supportive of Saudi-led coalition's war in Yemen are starting to take some heed back at home because they don't want to be seen as complicit to what's happening in Yemen.
Well, General Mattis has gone on record this week as saying, we want people around the peace table within 30 days. It's like, how likely is that to happen, do you think?
Well, actually, this afternoon we're going to hear from UN's Special Envoy, Martin Griffiths, who's in charge of the peace talks. The latest we heard last week was that he was having trouble convincing the Houthi rebels to come to the negotiating table. And we don't think that the 30-day deadline is going to be honored. It looks like Mr. Griffith has said that he hopes to get them to the negotiating table by the end of the year. We've also seen an accelerated attempt by the Saudi-led coalition, by the Emirati forces on the ground, and by airstrikes of Saudi Arabia in Yemen. I think that it's an attempt to really make military gains during this 30-day period that the U.S. Has called for an end to the conflict.
If you're just joining us, Farnaz Farsi is an award-winning Iranian-American journalist, senior writer for the Wall Street Journal. She's based out of New York, and she's joining us from the United Nations. 866-798-8255. If you have a question about some of the stories that broke in the news this week in the Middle East, Farnaz, earlier this year, Donald Trump violated the nuclear deal with Iran, promised that he would impose full economic and financial sanctions, and that actually came into force on Monday. So, Farnaz, what's in the package of sanctions?
The package of sanctions targets Iranian banks. It closes SWIFT to Iranian banks, which means banking transactions from Iran and to Iran are blocked. It has a list of government entities on sanctions, and it also sanctions the purchase of Iranian oil. Now, the Trump administration has given six-month waivers to some countries that rely on Iranian oil for them to try to find replacements to purchase the oil that they need. The Iranian currency started to plummet right after right around May, when news that Mr. Trump would be withdrawing from the nuclear agreement became confirmed, when that was confirmed. So you've had several months leading to the sanctions that there's been really market instability, economic instability, high inflation, more than 50% drop in the currency's value against the dollar. And many people are feeling that even before sanctions actually kick in. And when I speak to friends and sources and relatives in Iran, they say that some of them who are sick can't find the medications that they need, or that the medications are in short supply. They can find what they need at five times the price for a week, but it's not clear whether that medication will be available in the next few months. One of Iran's most respected charities, Mahak, which has a pediatric cancer hospital for poor children, reported that it's facing a crisis with trying to find chemo medication for children. And overall, there's just this sense of despair. Businesses are going bankrupt because they just can't keep up with the fluctuation in the rial, which is the Iranian currency. So sanctions are having a real impact on the lives of ordinary people, as they often do, unfortunately.
Well, it's not as if these are unintended consequences, right? Isn't this precisely what the Trump policy was designed to do?
The official line from the State Department, Treasury, and White House is that the sanctions are designed to pressure Iran to come to the negotiating table and renegotiate the nuclear deal and its regional policies and a list of other things that they've come up with. They say that that humanitarian aid and medicine is exempt from the sanctions. But when you consider that foreign pharmaceutical companies have had to exit Iran's market, and when you consider that both the government and the private sector in Iran can't really pay for importing medicine. Maybe importing medicine and exporting humanitarian aid is allowed, but if you actually don't have a way to pay for it because banking transactions are blocked, then that creates a crisis in the market. It increases the prices, and there's also a shortage. So it's having an unintended consequence, if you may, of hurting the people. And of course, as we've seen with sanctions in North Korea, with Iraq under Saddam, with Cuba, governments are seldom toppled because of sanctions. They find ways to go around them, and they actually benefit from them because they find their people within the establishment that try to navigate around them and make money. It's really the people that suffer.
But isn't that the whole idea, that the United States wants the people to put pressure on the government to come to the table? So when I say it's not an unintended
right.
consequence, the idea is to squeeze the people so that the population squeezes the politicians.
This is not what they say, but this is inevitably what might happen, or this might configure into their calculation, because in January we saw protests in Iran, in small cities in Iran, in throughout the country, economic protests, mostly by middle class and working class people. So that is a possibility. It's possible that there might be uprisings because people are going hungry. Yesterday, a video surfaced from one of the sugarcane factories where the workers were protesting and saying, we are hungry because they haven't been paid, and that, you know, their purchasing power has shrunk significantly.
The U.S. is certainly afraid of a spike in crude oil prices. That's the last thing that the Trump administration has wanted to see. So it exempted eight countries from sanctions on oil exports from Iran, and that included China, India, South Korea, Japan, Italy, Greece, Taiwan, and Turkey. So by allowing those eight countries, which account for about three-quarters of Iran's oil exports, they'll be able to import at least some oil for another 6 months or so. So talk about the extent to which oil is the lifeline and the United States' relationship with oil will play into the final outcome of these sanctions.
Well, the relationship with oil and oil market prices have a direct link to our earlier conversation about U.S. Wanting to protect Saudi Arabia's monarchy and Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia had pledged publicly to compensate for the oil that would be lost in the market by Iran's sanctions. So whatever the market lost, Saudi Arabia would increase its oil output and keep the oil prices stabilized. Now, if the U.S. were to really confront Saudi Arabia on the Khashoggi murder case or Yemen or other things, there's also the danger that they might actually not increase their oil output. And then we would see with the loss of Iran's oil, we would see a spike in the market, and then the economy of the U.S.
Okay.
And the world would be affected by the sanctions as well.
Thank you, Farnaz Fasihi, writer for The Wall Street Journal, for bringing us up to speed. Also, Ian McDougall of ProPublica and Craig Unger of Vanity Fair for joining us today. That's it for Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Renee Kemp, and this is Your Call.